Chapter 43. Disappointment at Sarnath. The road that ran through the jungle from Borivli to the Kanheri Caves was not so much a road as a broad sandy track. As we did not leave the town before noon, and as it was almost the hottest time of year, Satyabri and I had not walked above a mile or two before the loose drifts of silver sand became a burning marl that was agony to our bare feet. We limped along as best we could, however, and after a few more miles had the satisfaction of seeing in the distance not only the low-lying ranges of the Kanheri Hills, but also, as the road made a bend, the naked grey cliff face with the indentations that we knew were the Kanheri Caves. A few days earlier we had arrived in Bombay, and the friend with whom we were staying, the devotee of Swami Ram Das, had undertaken to show us various places of interest. Whether or not I had heard of the Kanheri Caves before, I no longer recollect, but as soon as I learned that they were only 5 miles from Borivli, and that Borivli was only 35 miles from Bombay, I was eager to pay them a visit. For 2 years I had had virtually no external contact with Buddhism, and I now felt for it the same desire that a starving man feels for food, or that a lover, long absent, feels for the sight of his beloved. As we picked our way from terrace to terrace, up and down the cliff face, I could not help feeling that it was worth waiting 2 years to see the Kanheri Caves. About 100 in number, and dating from the early centuries of the Common Era, they were of practically all shapes and sizes. Some were big enough to accommodate 400 or 500 people, and had obviously been used as assembly halls by the resident monastic community, while in others there was room only for a pair of inmates, perhaps 2 friends, or a senior monk and his disciple. 2 or 3 of the biggest and grandest caves had facades 30 or 40 feet high, with enormous mushroom-head pillars that were almost Egyptian in their squatness, strength, and simplicity. Many of the smallest, on the other hand, had porticos of almost contemporary design. Large or small, simple or ornate, all the caves were well supplied with drinking water. The intricacy and completeness of the water supply was indeed one of the marvels of the place. But most marvellous and impressive of all to me at that time were the 2 colossal standing Buddhas, 20 feet or more in height, that stood in decorated niches at either end of the vestibule of one of the biggest caves. Right hands hanging at their sides, palm outwards, in the gesture of supreme generosity. Left hands holding up to shoulder level the scalloped edges of their robes. They stood there in supernatural strength and solidity, the massively proportioned trunks and limbs clearly visible through the clinging draperies. As I stood beneath them, my head not much above the level of their ankles, I felt as though I was once again under the protection of Buddhism. As a result of walking on scorching hot sand, the soles of our feet were so badly blistered that for 2 or 3 days we were unable to go out. Our friend, who, though a goldsmith, also had some knowledge of traditional medicine, massaged them with clarified butter, as well as with a copper disc on which were inscribed various magic diagrams. He also gave us an account of his domestic troubles. He was in his early 40s, he said. His wife had been dead for some years, and there were no children. With him lived his younger brother, who was about 25, and who helped him in the business. This brother had recently married. Though his wife was both beautiful and well-behaved, and though the young couple were quite happy together, he himself could not get on with his sister-in-law. Any mistake she happened to commit irritated him intensely, and he was often so angry with her that he beat her. In fact, he confessed, up to the time of our arrival, he had been thrashing her every day. The young husband, who was of a gentle and submissive disposition, out of respect for his elder brother, made no effort to interfere. Satyapriya, ever an upholder of the right of the weaker sex to masculine protection, took our pious friend severely to task for his brutality. But it was evident that there were psychological complexities here beyond the reach of moral exhortation. When the soles of our feet had healed, we were taken out to other places of interest. One of these was the temple of Mumba Devi, the goddess to whom Bombay is dedicated, and of whose name the word Bombay is in fact a corruption. To our astonishment, we found the Sanctum Sanctorum so densely packed with an excited, jostling mass of Gujarati businessmen that we could hardly see anything at all. I noticed, though, that the walls were thickly plastered with rows of silver rupees. As we edged our way in the direction of the image, said to be of solid silver, a Gandhi-capped worshipper pressed a 2-rupee note into my hands with the entreaty, "You are a holy man. Please pray to the goddess that I may do well on the stock exchange today." Bombay was, of course, the commercial and financial capital of India. The Indian Stock Exchange was located there, and Mumba Devi herself, originally the patroness of the local fisherfolk, was now popularly regarded as a form of Lakshmi, the Hindu goddess of wealth. Though Satyapriya and I had come from Bangalore to Bombay, our real destination was Sarnath, and after we had spent 10 days with our goldsmith friend, we felt it was time for us to be on our way. It was already mid-April, and according to the Indian reckoning, the month of Vaishakha had begun. And at the back of both our minds, there was the hope that on the Vaishakha Purnima, or full moon day, anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment, it would be possible for us to be ordained. On our way to Sarnath, however, we still had one more call to make. As he put into our hands the third-class railway tickets that would carry us on to the next stage of our journey, our kind host strongly urged us to get down to a certain station near Lucknow and spend a few days at the ashram of a well-known Vedantic Swami, whose name he gave us. The Swami, he said reverently, was a Brahmanyani, a knower of the Absolute. Our curiosity naturally aroused. After more than a day and a night in the train, Satyapriya and I accordingly alighted at the station indicated and found our way to the Swami's ashram, which was a small building situated on the banks of the Ganges at some distance from the town. Within minutes of our arrival, we discovered that, whether or not the Swami was a knower of the Absolute, he was certainly a non-dualist Vedantin of the most virulent type. The world was nothing but an illusion, he declared. Spiritual practice was completely unnecessary. Since one was already in truth the Brahman, the Absolute, there was nothing whatever to realize. "Have you realized, Brahman?" demanded Satyapriya belligerently. "I've already told you there is nothing to realize," snapped the ascetic with evident irritation. "I am Brahman, so are you." This reply failed to satisfy my friend, who promptly returned to the attack, and for the next 2 hours, argument and counter-argument flew back and forth until the ashram fairly rang with the conflict. The Swami was by far the more experienced dialectician, and successfully maintained his position against all assaults. But in strength and stentoriousness of performance, Satyapriya was more than a match for him. As the debate proceeded, the Swami showed his irritation at what he clearly considered my friend's obtuseness more and more plainly, until finally the latter, descending to personalities, truculently demanded to know how it was possible for a Brahmanyani to give way to anger. "No one has given way to anger," shouted the Swami. "There's no such thing as anger. It's all an illusion." That night we stayed at the ashram, but after the unpleasantness of the debate and the Swami's subsequent scoffing references to our lack of spiritual development, The atmosphere of the place was so uncongenial that next day we left. Wandering along the banks of the Ganges, we came to a broad stretch of silver sand, which, scattered as it was with burnt-out funeral pyres, we at once recognised as a cremation ground. Here we decided to stay. The landscape could hardly have been more simple or more austere. Above us there was nothing but the dazzling blueness of the sky, from the midst of which the sun shone down with blinding brilliance. Around us nothing but the whiteness of the bare sands, through which the river, shrunken but still gigantic, rolled down its jade-green waters to the sea. Apart from ourselves, the only living things to be seen were the small, stunted trees that grew a few dozen yards from the bank. Not one of them stood more than 10 feet from the ground, with their crooked, even contorted branches and light green feathery foliage, most of it at the top. They looked like rudimentary umbrellas with bent handles, broken ribs and tattered silk. Here and there, four or five of the umbrellas stood closer than the rest, their scanty foliage running together into a single canopy-like strip of green. Beneath one of these canopies, Satchapriya and I took shelter from the heat. As soon as we had sat down, we became aware that for all the apparent barrenness of the place, we were in fact surrounded by a whole world of life and activity. Striped tree rats raced up and down the trunks of the trees, or peered round them at us, with bulging eyes and palpitating breasts. Cicadas shrilled invisible from the thin grass. Bees, deeply humming, flew heavily in and out of the pink or white blossoms of shrub after flowering shrub. But above all there were the peacocks. There seemed to be hundreds of them living among the trees. Every few moments, either from near at hand or far away, a harsh bell-like call, not unlike a greatly amplified meow, would ring loud and clear through the hot afternoon air, to be almost immediately answered by another. Lodged in the forks and lower branches of the trees were scores of huge, untidy nests, none of them more than 5 or 6 feet from the ground. On most of the nests, looking much too splendid for so humble a task, sat the cockbirds, the magnificent, many-eyed trains of their tails hanging over the nest edge and practically brushing the sandy soil below. Occasionally we would see a sudden vivid flash of gold, blue and green as one of the stately creatures, tail feathers streaming out behind like an enormous bunch of ribbons, would launch himself in clumsy horizontal flight among the trees. None of them took the slightest notice of us. When it was dark and the heat of the day had abated, we returned to the cremation ground, scrambled down the bank to the stretch of soft silver sand that was now part of the foreshore, but which, once the rainy season began, would soon be part of the riverbed. After we had plunged about for a few minutes, ankle-deep in the warm white drifts, we settled down among the shadowy shapes of the burnt-out funeral pyres for our evening meditation. When we opened our eyes some hours later, we found ourselves in another world. An electric white full moon was in the sky, and the whole landscape lay steeped in an unearthly silver radiance, so bright that we could hardly bear to look at it. Away on our right, the river ran glittering beneath the luminous blue of the sky, while all around us the low mounds of ashes and charred wood cast shadows black as ink onto the white sand. In the morning we made our way back to the ashram, and from there to the station. Though we had been deeply moved by the idyllic beauty of the spot, the full moon had reminded us that it was now only 28 days, or one lunar month, to the Vaishakha Purnima day, and we wanted to be in Benares as soon as possible. Before leaving the cremation ground, we spent half an hour rummaging among the heaps of ashes and charred wood looking for pieces of cloth. According to Buddhist tradition, the best and most suitable robe for a Buddhist monk was one made entirely of fragments of material picked up in a cremation ground. And in view of our forthcoming ordination, both Satchapriya and I thought it would be a good idea if, taking advantage of our present opportunity, we were to collect the necessary fragments and provide ourselves with this highly desirable type of robe. Unfortunately, we were disappointed. Though we succeeded in uncovering numerous fragments of charred bone, both large and small, very little was forthcoming in the way of cloth. At the end of our search, all we had found was 3 or 4 fragments, none of them more than 2 inches in width, and all so badly charred at the edges that we were left wondering how the ancient worthies had ever managed to stitch them together, even assuming that they had been able to collect a sufficient number of pieces for their purpose. On our arrival in Benares, we went straight to the local branch of the Ramakrishna Mission, where we hoped to be able to stay for a few days before making our way to Sarnath. After we had given our names and been asked to wait for a few minutes, a youthful novice ushered us into the president's office. To our astonishment, the smiling, saffron-clad figure who rose behind his desk to receive us was none other than our old friend Buddha Maharaj, whom I had last seen 2.5 years ago in Singapore. After returning to India and enjoying a period of rest and recuperation in the Himalayas, he had been posted to Benares, where he was now responsible for the management of the mission's hospital and dispensary. Within minutes of this unexpected meeting, Satchapriya and I were chatting with Buddha Maharaj as easily as if we had never parted, and had not only given our older and more experienced friend an up-to-date account of our adventures, but confided to him our aspirations for the future. Having spent 2 years as wandering ascetics, we declared, and having convinced ourselves of our ability to fulfil all the requirements of the monastic life, we were now desirous of formally dedicating ourselves to the following of the path to Nirvana and receiving ordination as Buddhist monks in the traditional manner. For this purpose, we were going to Sarnath, where there was a branch of the Mahabodhi Society, and where we hoped it would be possible for us to be ordained as Shramaneras, or novice monks. Imperturbable as ever, Buddha Maharaj received these confidences with the same cheerful benignity that he had exhibited in Singapore, and neither approved nor disapproved of our plan. One suggestion, however, he did make. Since we were in Benares, he said, and since Benares was not only one of the oldest cities in India, but the spiritual headquarters of Hinduism, it would be a pity if we did not visit at least some of its innumerable shrines and holy places. When Sri Ramakrishna had come on pilgrimage, he had seen the whole city as made entirely of gold, while above it, in the clouds, he had seen the god Shiva, the lord of Benares, receiving into heaven the souls of all who died within its precincts. If we were lucky, we too might be vouchsafed a glimpse of the splendours of the heavenly city, of that eternal Benares, of which, according to orthodox Hindu belief, the earthly Benares was but a pale reflection. Impatient though we were to reach Sarnath, Satchapriya and I accordingly spent the next few days sightseeing. Although, with the exception of the odd gilded dome or pinnacle, the narrow streets and crowded insanitary dwellings of the old city were to our eyes far from being made of gold, and though these swarms of beggars, holy men, pilgrims, and prostitutes seemed assured of anything but salvation, our excursions were by no means devoid of interest. Besides seeing the celebrated Ghats, where hundreds of pilgrims were taking a ceremonial dip in the greasy waters of the Ganges, we found our way to such widely different places as the newly built Anandamayi Ashram and the Benares branch of the Theosophical Society. The Arandamai ashram was a large building, beautifully situated on the banks of the river. But as Arandamai was elsewhere, it was practically deserted. And we wandered from room to room, looking at the large framed photographs of the Blissful Mother and the gaudy oleographs of Sri Krishna and Chaitanya. We also visited Bharat Mata Mandir, or Temple of Mother India. This was a large, rather unsightly modern building, said to have been inaugurated by Mahatma Gandhi. Instead of an image, the main hall enshrined an enormous relief map of India. Though not modelled strictly to scale, the Himalayas were shown many times higher than they should have been, it nevertheless gave one a good idea of the main geographical features of the subcontinent, besides furnishing a striking example of what Rabindranath Tagore called the idolatry of geography. As was usually the case with Satchapriya and me, our sightseeing included not only places but people. In the course of our visit to the Theosophical Society, we discovered that the well-known Theosophist Bhagavan Das, whose books I had read in Singapore, was a resident of the Holy City, and at once decided to go and see him. The venerable old scholar, who was then well over 70, received us on the veranda of his spacious suburban bungalow. Before long, we were deep in Indian philosophy and religion. Rather to our astonishment, we found that for all his veneer of theosophical universalism, he was at heart almost as orthodox a Hindu as Venkateshvara Iyer. For Buddhism, he had, it seemed, very little sympathy indeed, while he clearly had no sympathy at all, either for the life that we had been leading as wandering ascetics, or for our desire to receive ordination as Buddhist monks. As for our determination not to identify ourselves with any particular nationality, this was to him mere youthful eccentricity, and as such beyond the comprehension of the wise. However, on our departure, he presented us with an autographed copy of his book, The Essential Unity of All Religions, which I knew was highly esteemed in theosophical circles. After spending 3 or 4 days exploring the highways and byways of Benares, Satchapriya and I decided that we had had enough of sightseeing. It was now the hottest time of the year in one of the hottest parts of India, and since we had no money, having stopped handling it ever since our stay at Anandashram, we not only had to go everywhere on foot, but also to spend the whole day without refreshment of any kind. Not that we really minded this. The real reason for our decision lay much deeper. Despite our having acted on Buddha Maharaj's suggestion in good faith, we'd been feeling the pull of Sarnath more strongly each day, and in my case, at least, contact with Hinduism had served only to intensify my longing for Buddhism. Early in the morning, therefore, while it was still only moderately hot, we said goodbye to our inscrutable Swami friend and set out together on the 10 or 12 mile walk to Sarnath. Ever since I'd started reading about Buddhism, the name of Sarnath had been familiar to me, and for the last few months in particular, it had been, as it were, ringing in my ears. It was the place where, only 2 months after his attainment of perfect enlightenment, the Buddha had sought out the 5 ascetics who had been his companions in self-mortification in the days when he was still searching for the truth, and where, in the peaceful seclusion of the deer park, he had communicated to them the essentials of the newly discovered Dharma. After strong initial resistance, they had accepted him as their teacher, had realized the truth of his teaching for themselves, and had become the nucleus of the spiritual community, which, in the course of the next few months, rapidly sprung up around him. The road along which we were now walking was the very one, perhaps, which the Buddha himself had trod 2,500 years ago, on the last stage of his journey from Bodh Gaya. There were the same blue sky overhead, the same straggling suburbs, the same mud-walled huts, the same bands of naked children playing in the dust, the same creaking bullock carts, the same level fields on the other side of the road, and the same sun blazing more and more fiercely down on it all. After we had walked for a couple of hours and more, the road, which hitherto had meandered uncertainly, started to run very straight, as though it now knew exactly where it was going. Trees appeared at intervals on either hand. Before long, Satchapri and I found ourselves walking in the welcome shade of a broad avenue of fine mango trees, their glossy green foliage contrasting sharply with the dusty brown of the surrounding fields. Presently, on our right, we saw, through more mango trees, the dilapidated shell of a small railway station, whose outbuildings were little more than heaps of rubble. On the opposite side of the road, to our left, rose an enormous pile of bricks, surmounted, most incongruously, by an octagonal kiosk of Mughal design. This, I knew, was all that remained of the Chalkambi stupa, said to mark the spot where, on his arrival at Sarnath, the Buddha actually met the five ascetics. We were nearing our destination. Suddenly we saw, above the treetops, about a mile away, the pinkish-grey pinnacle of the Mula Gandakuti Vihara, the new Sinhalese temple constructed about 20 years earlier. We were there. After a few hundred yards, the road turned sharply to the right, and as though in a dream, we saw before us the park-like prospect of Sarnath. The next few days were among the pleasantest and most painful of my entire existence. Since it was the height of the hot season, when pilgrims were few, we had the whole place practically to ourselves, and after the congestion and clamour of Benares, the spaciousness and peace of Sarnath, with its green lawns, flowering trees, and cool, well-kept shrines, was delectable indeed. Though we saw practically everything of interest, the main object of our attention was, of course, the polished granite column set up by the Emperor Ashoka to mark the exact spot where the Buddha taught the five ascetics. This column, or what was left of it, stood in a roofed-in enclosure of its own, in the midst of several acres of ruined temples, monasteries, and votive stupas, all of which had been uncovered in the course of excavations and were now carefully preserved. The famous lion capital by which it had originally been surmounted was kept in the museum. Yet, beautiful as Sarnath was, I knew it had not always been so. Muslim invasion and Orthodox Hindu revival had between them levelled it to the ground, and for hundreds of years the very name of the place was virtually unknown. At the end of the last century, it was being used as a breeding ground for pigs. In the course of the last few decades, however, a great change had taken place, and with the establishment of temples and monasteries, and the provision of facilities for pilgrims, Sarnath had been restored to a modest semblance of its former glory. From my contact with the Mahabodhi Society in Calcutta, I knew that all this was due to the initiative of Anagarika Dharmapala, who had started there a branch of the society and built the Mula Gandakuti Vihara. Dharmapala himself had died nearly 20 years before, but his work was being continued by Sinhalese monks, some of whom had been his personal disciples. It was from these monks that we were hoping to receive ordination. Rarely in the history of Buddhism can two candidates for admission to the Sangha have been more quickly or more cruelly disappointed. Though we were allowed, rather grudgingly, to stay in the vast empty rest house, from the very first the attitude of the five or six resident monks towards us was clearly one of incomprehension, suspicion, and hostility. Our going barefoot might have been overlooked, and even our interest in meditation excused, But to be altogether without money was, we are made to feel, the unforgivable offence. Indeed, when we confess that we have been trying to practice the precept of not handling gold and silver, the observance of which was, of course, incumbent on chamaneres and bhikshus alike, and that for the past few months we had not possessed as much as a single anna between us, they reacted rather as though we had told them we had leprosy. From that moment our fate was sealed. In the eyes of these representatives of so-called pure Buddhism, we were no better than beggars, and it was clear they wanted nothing whatever to do with us. They were even unwilling to give us a little food. When, in response to the bell, we turned up at the dining hall, we heard one of them murmur angrily, "Why do they come without being asked?" After the open-handed hospitality of the Hindu ashrams we had visited, such an attitude came as a shock indeed. Nevertheless, we decided not to be discouraged. In the case of a step so important as the one we now wanted to take, difficulties were bound to arise, and the best thing we could do was to treat them as tests. Accordingly, at the first opportunity, we acquainted the monks with our religious history and made the formal request for ordination. After listening to our account in silence, they said they would consult among themselves and let us know the decision. It was not long in coming. They were all members of the Mahabodhi Society, they explained, and in view of the fact that the society would be responsible for the maintenance of monks ordained under its auspices, they were not permitted to ordain anyone without the consent of the General Secretary. Since the society was at present very short of funds, they were sure that in our case this consent would not be forthcoming. Though we had known what the verdict would be, the shock when it came was nonetheless acute. All our plans were laid in ruins, all our hopes destroyed. Bitterly disappointed, we returned to Benares.